It's hard for me to imagine a world in which moms don't walk around with baggies of goldfish and Cheerios in their purses to patch over the inevitable moments of angst. Jennifer, a mother and a reporter for the New York Times, complains that every activity her daughter attends, no matter how brief or at what time of day, now includes snacks. Apparently, we have collectively decided as a culture that it is impossible for children to take part in any activity without simultaneously shoving something into their pie holes, she writes. In France, the goûter is the official and only snack time. It's usually at about 4:30 p.m. when kids get out of school. It has the same fixed status as other mealtimes and is universally observed for kids. The goûter helps explain why those French kids I saw at the restaurant were eating so well. They were actually hungry, because they hadn't been snacking all day. Adults might have a coffee, but rarely a snack. A friend of mine who was visiting France complained that he had a hard time finding any adult snack food. Martine, the mother in the suburbs, says she never set out specifically to teach her kids patience, but her family's daily rituals, which I see reenacted in many other middle-class French homes, are an ongoing apprenticeship in how to delay gratification. Martine says she often buys Paulette candy. Bonbons are on display in most bakeries, but Paulette isn't allowed to eat the candy until that day's goûter, even if that means waiting many hours. Paulette is used to this. Martine sometimes has to remind her of the rule, but Paulette doesn't protest. Even though goûter isn't a free-for-all. The great thing is that there was cake to eat, recalls Clotilde Dussolier, a French food writer. But the flip side of the coin was that my mom would say, that's enough. It was also teaching kids restraint. Clotilde, who is now in her early 30s, says that as a kid she baked with her mother pretty much every weekend. It's not just what and when French families eat that make their meals little capsules of patience training. It's also how they eat and with whom. From a very young age, French kids get used to eating meals in courses with, at a minimum, a starter, a main course, and a dessert. They also get used to eating with their parents, which has to be better for learning patience. According to UNICEF, 90% of French 15-year-olds eat the main meal of the day with their parents several times per week. In the United States and the United Kingdom, it's about 67%. These meals aren't rushed affairs. In that study of women in Rennes, France, and in Ohio, the French women spent more than twice as much time eating each day. They surely pass on this pace to their kids. Fortunately, it's goûter time when the cupcakes come out of the oven at Martine's. Paulette happily eats two of them, but Martine doesn't even taste one. She seems to have tricked herself into thinking of cupcakes as child's food in order not to eat them. Sadly, I think she assumes I'm doing the same trick and doesn't offer me one. This is yet another way that French parents teach their kids to wait. They model waiting themselves. Little girls who grow up in homes where the mother doesn't eat the cupcake surely grow up to be women who don't eat the cupcake either. My own mother has many wonderful qualities, but she always eats the cupcake. It strikes me that Martine doesn't expect her daughter to be perfectly patient. She assumes that Paulette will sometimes grab stuff and make mistakes, but Martine doesn't overreact to these mistakes the way that I tend to. She understands that all this baking and waiting is practice in building a skill. In other words, Martine is even patient about teaching patience. When Paulette tries to interrupt our conversation, Martine says, "Just wait 2 minutes, my little one. I'm in the middle of talking." It's both very polite and very firm. I'm struck both by how sweetly Martine says it and by how certain she seems that Paulette will obey her. Martine has been teaching her children patience since they were tiny. When Paulette was a baby, Martine usually waited 5 minutes before picking her up when she cried. And, of course, Paulette did her nights at 2.5 months. Martine also teaches her kids a related skill, learning to play by themselves. "The most important thing is that he learns to be happy by himself," she says of her son, Auguste. A child who can play by himself can draw upon this skill when his mother is on the phone. And it's a skill that French mothers explicitly try to cultivate in their kids more than American mothers do. In another study of college-educated mothers in the United States and France, the American mom said that encouraging one's child to play alone was of average importance, but the French moms said it was very important. Parents who value this ability are probably more apt to leave a child alone when he's playing well by himself. When French mothers say that it's important to take cues from a child's own rhythm, part of what they mean is that when the child is busy playing, they leave him alone. This seems to be another example of French mothers and caregivers intuitively following the best science. Walter Michel says the worst-case scenario for a kid from 18 to 24 months of age is the child is busy, and the child is happy, and the mother comes along with a fork full of spinach. The mothers who really foul it up are the ones who are coming in when the child is busy and doesn't want or need them, and are not there when the child is eager to have them. So becoming alert to that is absolutely critical. Indeed, an enormous U.S. government study of the effects of childcare found that what's especially crucial is a mother's, or caregiver's, sensitivity, how attuned she is to her child's experience of the world. The sensitive mother is aware of the child's needs, moods, interests, and capabilities, a backgrounder explains. She allows this awareness to guide her interactions with her child. Conversely, having a depressed mother is very bad, because the depression stops the mother from tuning in to her child. Michel's conviction about the importance of sensitivity doesn't just come from research. He says that his own mother was alternately smothering and absent. Michel still can't ride a bike, because she was too afraid of head injuries to let him learn. But neither of his parents came to hear him give the valedictory address at his high school graduation. Of course, American parents want their kids to be patient. We believe that patience is a virtue. We encourage our kids to share, to wait their turns, to set the table, and to practice the piano. But patience isn't a skill that we hone quite as assiduously as French parents do. As with sleep, we tend to view whether kids are good at waiting as a matter of temperament. In our view, parents either luck out and get a child who waits well, or they don't. French parents and caregivers can't believe that we're so laissez-faire about this crucial ability. For them, having kids who need instant gratification would make life unbearable. When I mentioned the topic of this book at a dinner party in Paris, my host, a French journalist, launches into a story about the year he lived in Southern California. He and his wife, a judge, had befriended an American couple and decided to spend a weekend away with them in Santa Barbara. It was the first time they'd met each other's kids, who ranged in age from about 7 to 15. From my host's perspective, the weekend quickly became maddening. Years later, they still remember how the American kids frequently interrupted the adults mid-sentence, and there were no fixed mealtimes. The American kids just went to the refrigerator and took food whenever they wanted. To the French couple, it seemed like the American kids were in charge.
"What struck us and bothered us was that the parents never said no," the journalist said.
"They did n'importe quoi," his wife added.
This was apparently contagious.
"The worst part is, our kids started doing n'importe quoi too," she says.
After a while, I realized that most French descriptions of American kids include this phrase, n'importe quoi, meaning whatever, or anything they like. It suggests that the American kids don't have firm boundaries, that their parents lack authority, and that anything goes. It's the antithesis of the French ideal of the cadre, or frame, that French parents talk about. Cadre means that kids have very firm limits, that's the frame, and that the parents strictly enforce those limits. But within those limits, the kids have a lot of freedom. American parents impose limits too, of course, but often they're different from the French ones. In fact, French people often find these American limits shocking. Laurence, the nanny from Normandy, tells me she won't work for American families anymore, and that several of her nanny friends won't either. She says she quit her last job with Americans after just a few months, mostly over the issue of limits.
"It was difficult, because it was n'importe quoi. The child does what he wants, when he wants, Laurence says.
Laurence is tall, with short hair, and a gentle, no-nonsense manner. She's reluctant to offend me, but she says that compared with the French families she's worked for, in the American homes there was much more crying and whining. This is the first time that I hear the onomatopoeic French verb chouiner, to whine. The last American family she worked for had three kids, ages 8, 5, and 18 months. For the 5-year-old girl, whining was her national sport. She whined all the time, with tears that could fall at a moment's notice. Laurence believed that it was best to ignore the girl, so as not to reinforce the whining. But the girl's mother, who was often home in another room, usually rushed in and capitulated to whatever the girl was asking for. Laurence says the 8-year-old son was worse. He always wanted a little bit more, and a little bit more. She says that when his escalating demands weren't met, he became hysterical. Laurence's conclusion is that, in such a situation, the child is less happy. He's a little bit lost. In the families where there is more structure, not a rigid family, but a bit more cadre, everything goes much more smoothly. Laurence's breaking point came when the mother of the American family insisted that Laurence put the two older kids on a diet. Laurence refused, and said she would simply feed them balanced meals. Then she discovered that after she put the kids to bed and left, at about 8:30 p.m., the mother would feed them cookies and cake.
They were stout, Laurence says of the three children.
Stout? I ask.
I say stout, so I don't say fat, she says.
I'd like to write off this story as a stereotype. Obviously, not all American kids behave this way, and French kids do plenty of n'importe quoi, too. Bean will later say sternly to her 8-month-old brother, in imitation of her own teachers,
Tu ne peux pas faire n'importe quoi.
You can't do whatever. But the truth is, in my own home, I've witnessed American kids doing quite a lot of n'importe quoi. When American families come over, the grown-ups spend much of the time chasing after or otherwise tending to their kids. Maybe in about 5 years, we'll be able to have a conversation, jokes a friend from California, who's visiting Paris with her husband and two daughters, ages 7 and 4. We've been trying for an hour just to finish our cups of tea. She and her family arrived at our house after spending the day touring Paris, during which the younger daughter, Rachel, threw a series of spectacular tantrums. When the dinner I'm preparing isn't ready, both parents come into the kitchen and say that their girls probably can't wait much longer. When we finally sit down, they let Rachel crawl under the table while the rest of us, Bean included, eat dinner. The parents explain that Rachel is tired, so she can't control herself. Then they wax about her prodigious reading skills and her possible admission to a gifted kindergarten. During the meal, I feel something stroking my foot. Rachel is tickling me, I tell her parents nervously. A moment later, I yelp. The gifted child has bitten me. Setting limits for kids isn't a French invention, of course. Plenty of American parents and experts also think limits are very important. But in the United States, this runs up against the competing idea that kids need to express themselves. I sometimes feel that the things Bean wants, to have apple juice instead of water, to wear a princess dress to the park, to be carried instead of pushed in a stroller, are immutable and primordial. I don't concede to everything, but repeatedly blocking her urges feels wrong and possibly even damaging. It's also just hard for me to conceive of Bean as someone who can sit through a 4-course meal or play quietly when I'm on the phone. I'm not even sure I want her to do those things. Will it crush her spirit? Would I be stifling her self-expression and her possibility of starting the next Facebook? With all these doubts, I often capitulate. I'm not the only one. At Bean's 4th birthday party, one of her English-speaking friends walks in carrying a wrapped present for Bean and another one for himself. His mother says he got upset at the shop because he wasn't getting a present, too. My friend Nancy tells me about a new parenting philosophy that's meant to eliminate this battle of wills. You never let your child hear the word no, so that he can't say it back to you. In France, there's no such ambivalence about no. You must teach your child frustration, is a French parenting maxim. In my favorite series of French kids' books, Princesse Parfaite, Perfect Princess, the heroine, Zoé, is pictured pulling her mother toward a crepe stand. The text explains, while walking past the creperie, Zoé made a scene. She wanted a crepe with blackberry jam. Her mother refused, because it was just after lunch. On the next page, Zoé is back in the bakery, dressed as the perfect princess of the title. This time, she's covering her eyes so she won't see the piles of fresh brioche. She's being sage. As Zoé knows, to avoid being tempted, she turns her head to the other side, the text says. It's worth noting that in the first scene, where Zoé isn't getting what she wants, she's crying. But in the second one, where she's distracting herself, she's smiling. The message is that children will always have the impulse to give in to their vices, but they're happier when they're sage and in command of themselves. It's also worth noting that Parisian parents don't let their little girls go shopping in princess outfits. Those are strictly for parties and for dressing up at home. In the book A Happy Child, French psychologist Didier Pleu argues that the best way to make a child happy is to frustrate him.
That doesn't mean that you prevent him from playing or that you avoid hugging him, Pleu says. One must, of course, respect his tastes, his rhythms, and his individuality. It's simply that the child must learn from a very young age that he's not alone in the world, and that there's a time for everything.
I'm struck by how different the French expectations are when, on that same seaside holiday when I witnessed all the French kids happily eating in restaurants, I take Bean into a shop filled with perfectly aligned stacks of striped mariner t-shirts in bright colors. Bean immediately begins pulling them down. She barely pauses when I scold her. To me, Bean's bad behavior seems predictable for a toddler, so I'm surprised when the saleswoman says, without malice,
I've never seen a child do that before.
I apologize and head for the door. Walter Michel says that capitulating to kids starts a dangerous cycle.
If kids have the experience that when they're told to wait, that if they scream, mommy will come and the wait will be over, they will very quickly learn not to wait. Non-waiting and screaming and carrying on and whining are being rewarded.
French parents delight in the fact that each child has his own temperament, but they take for granted that any healthy child is capable of not whining, not collapsing after he's told no, and generally not nagging or grabbing stuff. French parents are more inclined to view a child's somewhat random demands as caprices, impulsive fancies or whims. They have no problem saying no to these demands. I think French women understand earlier than American women that kids can have demands, and those demands are unrealistic, a pediatrician who treats French and American children tells me. A French psychologist writes that when a child has a caprice, for instance, his mother is in a shop with him and he suddenly demands a toy, the mother should remain extremely calm and gently explain that buying the toy isn't in the day's plan. Then she should try to bypass the caprice by redirecting the child's attention, for example, by telling a story about her own life. Stories about parents are always interesting to children, the psychologist says. After reading this, in every crisis I shout to Simon, "Tell a story about your life!" The psychologist says that throughout this, the mother should stay in close communication with the child by embracing him or looking him in the eye, but she must also make him understand that he can't have everything right away. It's essential not to leave him thinking that he is all-powerful and that he can do everything and have everything. French parents don't worry that they're going to damage their kids by frustrating them. To the contrary, they think their kids will be damaged if they can't cope with frustration. They also treat coping with frustration as a core life skill. Their kids simply have to learn it. The parents would be remiss if they didn't teach it. Laurence, the nanny, says that if a child wants her to pick him up while she's cooking, it's enough to explain to him, I can't pick you up right now, and then tell him why. Laurence says her charges don't always take this well, but she stays firm and lets the child express his disappointment. I don't let him cry 8 hours, but I let him cry, she says. I explain to him that I can't do otherwise. This happens a lot when she's watching several children at once. If you are busy with one child and another child wants you, if you can pick him up, obviously you do, but if not, I let him cry. The French expectation that even little kids should be able to wait comes in part from the darker days of French parenting, when children were expected to be quiet and obedient. But it also comes from the belief that even babies are rational people who can learn things. According to this view, when we rush to feed Bean whenever she whimpers, we're treating her like an addict, whereas expecting her to have patience would be a way of respecting her. As with teaching kids to sleep, French experts view learning to cope with no as a crucial step in a child's evolution. It forces them to understand that there are other people in the world with needs as powerful as their own. A French child psychiatrist writes that this éducation should begin when a baby is 3 to 6 months old. His mother begins to make him wait a bit sometimes, thus introducing a temporal dimension into his spirit. It's thanks to these little frustrations that his parents impose on him day after day, along with their love, that lets him withstand and allows him to renounce between ages 2 and 4 his all-powerfulness in order to humanize him. This renunciation is not always loud, but it's an obligatory passage. In the French view, I'm doing Bean no service by catering to her whims. French experts and parents believe that hearing no rescues children from the tyranny of their own desires. As small children, you have needs and desires that basically have no ending. This is a very basic thing. The parents are there. That's why you have frustration, to stop that process, says Caroline Thompson, a family psychologist who runs a bilingual practice in Paris. Thompson, who has a French mother and an English father, points out that kids often get very angry at their parents when parents block them. She says English-speaking parents often interpret this anger as a sign that the parents are doing something wrong. But she warns that parents shouldn't mistake angering a child for bad parenting. To the contrary, if the parent can't stand the fact of being hated, then he won't frustrate the child, and then the child will be in a situation where he will be the object of his own tyranny, where basically he has to deal with his own greed and his own need for things. If the parent isn't there to stop him, then he's the one who's going to have to stop himself, or not stop himself, and that's much more anxiety-provoking. Thompson's view reflects what seems to be the consensus in France. Making kids face up to limitations and deal with frustration turns them into happier, more resilient people. And one of the main ways to gently induce frustration on a daily basis is to make children wait a bit. As with the pause as a sleep strategy, French parents have homed in on this one thing. They treat waiting not just as one important skill among many, but as a cornerstone of raising kids. I'm still mystified by France's national baby feeding schedule. How do French babies all end up eating at the same times if their mothers don't make them do it? When I point this out, mothers continue to wax about rhythms and flexibility and about how each child is different. But after a while, I realize that they also take a few principles for granted, even if they don't always mention them. The first is that, after the first few months, a baby should eat at roughly the same times each day. The second is that babies should have a few big feeds rather than a lot of small ones. And the third is that the baby should fit into the rhythm of the family. So while it's true that mothers don't force their babies onto a schedule, they do nudge them toward it by observing these three principles. The parenting book, Your Child, says the ideal is to breastfeed on demand for the first few months and then bring the baby, progressively and flexibly, to regular hours that are more compatible with daily life. If parents follow these principles, and the baby wakes up at 7 or 8, and they think he should wait about 4 hours between meals, he's going to be routed onto the national meal plan. He'll eat in the morning. He'll eat again around noon. He'll have an afternoon feed around 4, and then he'll eat again at about 8 p.m. before going to bed. When the baby cries at 10:30 a.m., his parents are going to assume that what's best for him is to wait until lunchtime and have a big feed then. It might take a while for him to ease into this rhythm. Parents ease babies onto this schedule gradually, not abruptly. But eventually, the baby gets used to it, the same way that grown-ups do. His parents get used to it too, and it allows the whole family to eat together. Martine says that for the first few months, she nursed Paulette on demand. Around the third month, to get her to wait 3 hours between feeds, she took her for walks or put her in a sling where Paulette would usually quickly stop crying. Martine then did the same thing when she wanted to space the feeding times out to 4 hours. She says she never let either of her kids cry for very long. Gradually, they just fell into the rhythm of eating 4 times a day. "I was really flexible. I'm just like that," she says. The critical assumption is that while the baby has his own rhythm, the family and the parents have rhythms too. The ideal in France is finding a balance between these two. Your child explains, "You and your baby each have your rights, and every decision is a compromise." Bean's regular pediatrician never mentioned this 4-meal-a-day plan to me, but he's away at Bean's next appointment. His replacement is a young French woman who has a daughter about Bean's age. When I ask her about the schedule, she says that, bien sûr, Bean should only be eating 4 times a day. Then the doctor grabs some Post-its and scribbles down the schedule. It's the same one again, morning, noon, 4 p.m., and 8 p.m. When I later ask Bean's regular doctor why he never mentioned this, he says he prefers not to suggest schedules to American parents because they tend to become too doctrinaire about them. It takes a few weeks, but we gradually nudge Bean onto this schedule. It turns out that she can take the weight. She just needed a bit of practice. Gâteau au yaourt, yogurt cake. 2 6-ounce containers plain whole milk yogurt. Use the empty containers to measure the other ingredients. 2 eggs. 2 containers sugar, or just 1, depending on how sweet you like it. 1 teaspoon vanilla. Just under 1 container vegetable oil. 4 containers flour. 1½ teaspoons baking powder. Crème fraîche, optional. Preheat oven to 375 degrees Fahrenheit. Use vegetable oil to grease a 9-inch round cake pan or a loaf pan. Gently combine the yogurt, eggs, sugar, vanilla, and oil. In a separate bowl, mix the flour and baking powder. Add the dry ingredients to the wet ingredients. Mix gently until ingredients are just combined. Don't overmix. You can add 2 containers frozen berries, a container of chocolate chips, or any flavoring you like. Bake for 35 minutes, then 5 minutes more if the cake doesn't pass the knife test. It should be almost crispy on the outside, but springy on the inside. Let it cool. The cake is delicious, served with tea and a dollop of crème fraîche. Chapter 5. Tiny Little Humans. When Bean is 1.5 years, we register her at the Center for the Adaptation of the Young Child to the Aquatic Milieu, also known as Babies in the Water. It's a weekly paid swimming class organized by our local town hall and held every Saturday at one of the public pools in our neighborhood. A month before the first class, the organizers summon parents to an informational meeting. The other parents seem a lot like us, college-educated and willing to push strollers into the cold on Saturday mornings in order to teach their kids to swim. Each family is assigned a 45-minute swimming slot and reminded that, as in all public pools in Paris, men must wear Speedos, not trunks. This is supposedly for hygiene. Men could wear swim trunks elsewhere and thus carry dirt into the pool. The 3 of us arrive at the pool, get undressed, and put on our swimsuits as discreetly as possible in the co-ed changing room. Then we slip into the pool alongside the other kids and their parents. Bean throws around some plastic balls, goes down the slide, and jumps off the rafts. At one point, an instructor paddles up to us and introduces himself, then swims away. Before we know it, our time is up, and the next shift of parents and kids is climbing into the pool. I figure that this must be an introductory class, and that the lessons will begin the following week. But at the next class, it's the same thing. Lots of splashing around, but no one teaching anyone how to kick, blow bubbles, or otherwise begin to swim. In fact, there's no organized instruction at all. Every so often, the same instructor paddles by and makes sure we're happy. This time, I corner him in the pool. When is he going to start teaching my daughter how to swim? He smiles indulgently at me. Children don't learn how to swim in babies in the water, he says, as if this is completely obvious. I later learn that Parisian kids typically don't learn to swim until they're six. So what are we all doing here? He says the point of these sessions is for children to discover the water and to awaken to the sensations of being in it. Huh? Bean has already discovered water in the bathtub. I want her to swim, and I want her to swim as early as possible, preferably by age two. That's what I thought I'd paid for, and why I dragged my family out of bed on a frigid Saturday morning. I suddenly look around and realize that all those parents at the informational meeting knew that they were signing up for their kid to merely discover and awaken to the water, not to learn how to swim. Do their kids discover the piano too, instead of learning how to play it? It strikes me that French parents aren't just doing a few things differently. They have a whole different view of how kids learn and of who they are. I don't just have a swimming class problem. I seem to have a philosophical problem, too. In the 1960s, the Swiss psychologist Jean Piaget came to America to share his theories on the stages of children's development. After each talk, someone in the audience typically asked him what he began calling the American question. It was, how can we speed these stages up? Piaget's answer was, why would you want to do that? He didn't think that pushing kids to acquire skills ahead of schedule was either possible or desirable. He believed that children reach these milestones at their own speeds, driven by their own inner motors. The American question sums up an essential difference between French and American parents. We Americans assign ourselves the job of pushing, stimulating, and carrying our kids from one developmental stage to the next. The better we are at parenting, we think, the faster our kids will develop. In my Anglophone playgroup in Paris, some of the mothers flaunt the fact that their kids take music classes or that they go to a separate Portuguese-speaking playgroup. But often these same mothers are cagey about revealing any details of the activities so that no one else can sign up their kids. These mothers would never admit that they're being competitive, but the feeling is palpable. French parents just don't seem so anxious for their kids to get head starts. They don't push them to read, swim, or do math ahead of schedule. They aren't trying to prod them into becoming prodigies. I don't get the feeling that, surreptitiously or otherwise, we're all in a race for some unnamed prize. They do sign their kids up for tennis, fencing, and English lessons, but they don't parade these activities as proof of what good parents they are. Nor are they guarded when talking about the classes, like they're some sort of secret weapon. In France, the point of enrolling a child in Saturday morning music class isn't to activate some neural network. It's to have fun. Like that swimming instructor, French parents believe in awakening and discovery. In fact, French parents have a different view of the nature of a child. When I start to read about what this view is, I keep coming across two people who lived 200 years apart, the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau and a French woman I had never previously heard of named Françoise Dolto. They're the two great influences on French parenting, and their spirits are very much alive in France today. The modern French idea of how to parent starts with Rousseau. The philosopher wasn't himself much of a parent, or like Piaget, even a native Frenchman. He was born in Geneva in 1712 and didn't have an ideal childhood. His mother died 10 days after he was born. His only sibling, an older brother, ran away from home. Later, his father, a watchmaker, fled Geneva because of a business dispute, leaving Jean-Jacques behind with an uncle. Rousseau eventually moved to Paris, where he abandoned his own children to orphanages soon after they were born. He said this was to protect the honor of their mother, a former seamstress whom he'd hired as a servant. None of this stopped Rousseau from publishing Émile, or On Education, in 1762. It describes the education of a fictional boy named Émile, who will, after puberty, meet the lovely and equally fictional Sophie. The German philosopher Immanuel Kant later compared the book's significance to that of the French Revolution. French friends tell me they read it in high school. Émile's impact is so enduring that passages and catchphrases from it are modern-day parenting clichés, like the importance of awakening. And French parents still take many of its precepts for granted. Émile was published during a dire time for French parenting. A Parisian police official estimated that of the 21,000 babies born in Paris in 1780, 19,000 were sent to live with wet nurses as far away as Normandy or Burgundy. Some of these newborns died en route, bouncing around in the back of cold wagons. Many others died in the care of the poorly paid, overburdened wet nurses, who took on too many babies and often kept them tightly swaddled for long periods, supposedly to keep them from hurting themselves. For working-class parents, wet nurses were an economic choice. It was cheaper to pay a nurse than to hire someone to replace the mother in the family store. For upper-class mothers, however, it was a lifestyle choice. There was social pressure to be free to enjoy a sophisticated social life. The child interferes not just in his mother's married life, but also in her pleasures, writes a French social historian. Taking care of a child was neither amusing nor chic. Rousseau tried to upend all of this with Émile. He urged mothers to breastfeed their own babies. He decried swaddling, padded bonnets, and leading strings, the child's safety devices of his day.
Far from being attentive to protecting Émile from injury, I would be most distressed if he were never hurt and grew up without knowing pain, Rousseau wrote. If he grabs a knife, he will hardly tighten his grip and will not cut himself very deeply.
Rousseau thought children should be given space to let their development unfold naturally. He said Émile should be taken daily to the middle of a field. There let him run and frisk about. Let him fall 100 times a day. He imagined a child who was free to explore and discover the world and let his senses gradually awaken. In the morning, let Émile run barefoot in all seasons, he wrote. He allows the fictional Émile to read just a single book, Robinson Crusoe. Until I read Émile, I was mystified by all the talk among French parents and educators about letting children awaken and discover. One of the teachers at Bean's daycare gushed at a parents' meeting that the kids go to a local gymnasium on Thursday mornings, not to exercise, but to discover their bodies. The daycare's mission statement says that kids should discover the world in pleasure and gaiety. Another center nearby is simply called Enfance et Découverte, Childhood and Discovery. The highest compliment anyone seems to pay a baby in France is that she is éveillée, alert and awakened. Unlike in America, this isn't a euphemism for ugly. Awakening is about introducing a child to sensory experiences, including tastes. It doesn't always require the parent's active involvement. It can come from staring at the sky, smelling dinner as it's being prepared, or playing alone on a blanket. It's a way of sharpening the child's senses and preparing him to distinguish between different experiences. It's the first step toward teaching him to be a cultivated adult who knows how to enjoy himself. Awakening is a kind of training for children in how to profiter, to soak up the pleasure and richness of the moment. I'm in favor of all this awakening, of course. Who wouldn't be? I'm just puzzled by the emphasis. We American parents, as Piaget discovered, tend to be more interested in having kids acquire concrete skills and reach developmental milestones. And we tend to think that how well and how quickly kids advance depends on what their parents do. That means that parents' choices and the quality of their intervention are extremely important. In this light, baby sign language, pre-reading strategies, and picking the right preschool understandably seem crucial. So does the never-ending American search for parenting experts and advice. I see this cultural difference in my little Parisian courtyard. Bean's room is filled with black and white flashcards, baby blocks with the ABCs printed on them, and the now discredited Baby Einstein DVDs that we've gladly received as gifts from American friends and family. We play Mozart constantly to stimulate her cognitive development. But my French neighbor, Anne, the architect, had never heard of Baby Einstein. She wasn't interested when I told her about it. Anne likes to let her little girl sit and play with old toys bought at yard sales or meander around our shared courtyard. I later mentioned to Anne that there is an opening at our local preschool. Bean, who is among the oldest kids in her daycare, could start a year early. This would mean taking her out of daycare, where I fear she isn't being sufficiently challenged.
"Why would you want to do that?" Anne asks. "There are so few years to just be a child."
A University of Texas study found that with all this awakening, French mothers aren't trying to help their kids' cognitive development or make them advance in school. Rather, they believe that awakening will help their kids forge inner psychological qualities such as self-assurance and tolerance of difference. Others believe in exposing children to a variety of tastes, colors, and sights, simply because doing so gives the children pleasure. This pleasure is the motivation for life, one of the mothers says.
If we didn't have pleasure, we wouldn't have any reason to live.
In the 21st century Paris of parents and children that I inhabit, Rousseau's legacy takes two apparently contradictory forms. On the one hand, there's the frolicking in the fields, or the pool, but on the other hand, there's quite strict discipline. Rousseau says that a child's freedom should be bound by firm limits and strong parental authority.
"Do you know the surest means of making your child miserable?" he writes. "It is to accustom him to getting everything. Since his desires grow constantly due to the ease of satisfying them, sooner or later, powerlessness will force you, in spite of yourself, to end up with a refusal. And this unaccustomed refusal will give him more torment than being deprived of what he desires."
Rousseau says the biggest parenting trap is to think that because a child can argue well, his argument deserves the same weight as your own.
"The worst education is to leave him floating between his will and yours, and to dispute endlessly between you and him as to which of the two will be the master."
For Rousseau, the only possible master is the parent. He often seems to be describing the cadre, or frame, that is the model for today's French parents. The ideal of the cadre is that parents are very strict about certain things, but very relaxed about most everything else. Fanny, the publisher with two young children, tells me that before she even had kids, she heard a well-known French actor on the radio talking about being a parent. He put her ideas about the cadre and the way she herself was raised into words. He said,
"Education is a firm cadre, and inside is liberty. I really like that. I think the kid is reassured. He knows he can do what he wants, but some limits will always be there."
Almost all the French parents I meet describe themselves as strict. This doesn't mean that they're constantly ogres. It means that, like Fanny, they are very strict about a few key things. These form the backbone of the cadre.
"I tend to be severe all of the time, a little bit," Fanny says. "There are some rules I've found that if you let go, you tend to take two steps backward. I rarely let these go."
For Fanny, these areas are eating, sleeping, and watching TV.
"For all the rest, she can do what she wants," she tells me about her daughter Lucy.
Even within these key areas, Fanny tries to give Lucy some freedom and choices.
"With the TV, it's no TV, just DVDs, but she chooses which DVD. I just try to do that for everything. Dressing up in the morning, I tell her. At home, you can dress however you want. If you want to wear a summer shirt in wintertime, okay. But when we go out, we decide. It works for the moment. We'll see what happens when she's 13. The point of the cadre isn't to hem the child in. It's to create a world that's predictable and coherent to her. You need that cadre, or I think you get lost, Fanny says. It gives you confidence. You have confidence in your kid, and your kid feels it. The cadre feels enlightened and empowering for kids. But Rousseau's legacy has a darker side, too. When I bring Bean to get her first inoculations, I cradle her in my arms and apologize to her for the pain she's about to experience. The French pediatrician scolds me.
You don't say I'm sorry, he says. Getting shot is part of life. There's no reason to apologize for that.
He seems to be channeling Rousseau, who said,
If by too much care you spare them every kind of discomfort, you are preparing great miseries for them.
I'm not sure what Rousseau thought about suppositories. Rousseau wasn't sentimental about children. He wanted to make good citizens out of impressionable lumps of clay. Many thinkers continued to view babies as tabula rasa, blank slates, for hundreds of years. Near the end of the 19th century, the American psychologist and philosopher William James said that to an infant, the world is one great blooming, buzzing confusion. Well into the 20th century, it was taken for granted that children only slowly begin understanding the world and the fact of their own presence in it. In France, the idea that kids are second-class beings who only gradually gain status persisted into the 1960s. I've met Frenchmen now in their 40s who, as children, weren't allowed to speak at the dinner table unless they were first addressed by an adult. Children were often expected to be sage comme une image, quiet as a picture, the equivalent of the old English dictum that children should be seen but not heard. This conception of children began changing in France in the late 1960s. In March 1968, a student protest at the University of Paris, Nanterre, snowballed into a series of student and worker revolts across the country. 2 months later, 11 million French workers were on strike, and President Charles de Gaulle dissolved the National Assembly. Although the protesters had some specific financial demands, what many of them really wanted was a whole different way of life. France's religious, socially conservative, male-dominated society, in place for centuries, suddenly seemed dated. The protesters envisioned a kind of personal liberation that included different life options for women, less rigid a class hierarchy, and a daily existence that wasn't just about métro, boulot, dodo, commute, work, sleep. Eventually, the French government broke up the protests, sometimes violently, but the revolt had a profound impact on French society. France is now, for example, one of the least religious countries in Europe. The authoritarian model of parenting was a casualty of 1968, too. If everyone was equal, why couldn't children speak at dinner? The pure Rousseauian model, children as blank slates, didn't suit France's newly emancipated society, and the French were fascinated by psychoanalysis. It suddenly seemed that by shutting kids up, parents might be screwing them up, too. French kids were still expected to be well-behaved and to control themselves, but gradually after 1968, they were encouraged to express themselves, too. The young French parents I know often use sage to mean self-controlled, but also happily absorbed in an activity. Before, it was sage like a picture. Now it's sage and awakened, explained the French psychologist and writer Maryse Vaillant, herself a member of the famous Generation of 68. Into this generational upheaval walked Françoise Dotto, the other titan of French parenting. French people I speak to, even those without kids, can't believe that Americans haven't heard of Françoise Dotto, or that only one of her books has ever been translated into English. It is long out of print. In France, Dotto is a household name, a bit like Dr. Benjamin Spock used to be in the United States. The centenary of her birth was celebrated in 2008 with a flood of articles, tributes, and even a made-for-TV movie about her life. UNESCO convened a 3-day conference on Dolto in Paris. Her books are for sale in practically every French bookshop. In the mid-1970s, Dolto was in her late 60s and was already the most famous psychoanalyst and pediatrician in France. In 1976, a French radio station began broadcasting daily 12-minute programs in which Dolto responded to listeners' letters about parenting.
"Nobody imagined the immediate and lasting success of the program," recalled Jacques Pradel, then its 27-year-old host.
He describes her responses to readers' questions as
brilliance, bordering on premonition. "I don't know where she got her answers," he says.
When I watch film clips of Dolto from that period, I can see why she appealed to anxious parents. With her thick glasses and matronly outfits, she had the bearing of a wise grandmother. The famous person she most resembles is Golda Meir, and like her American counterpart, Dr. Spock, Dolto had the gift of making everything she said, even her more outrageous claims, sound like common sense. Dolto may have looked like everyone's grand-mère, but her message about how to treat kids was deliciously radical and fitting for the new times. In a sort of emancipation of babies, she claimed that even infants are rational, and indeed that they understand language as soon as they're born. It's an intuitive, almost mystical message, and it's a message that ordinary French people still embrace, even if they don't all articulate it exactly. Once I read Dolto, I realize that so many of the most curious claims that I've heard French parents make, like the one that you're supposed to talk to babies about their sleep troubles, come straight from her. Dolto's radio broadcasts made her into an almost mythic figure in France. Well into the 1980s, books containing transcripts of the broadcasts and other conversations were stacked like produce in French supermarkets. A whole cohort of children were known as Génération Dolto. A psychoanalyst quoted in a special Dolto-themed edition of Télérama magazine in 2008, recalled riding in a taxi whose driver said he never missed the radio show.
"He was dumbfounded," he said. "She talks to children like they are human beings."
Dolto's core message isn't a parenting philosophy. It doesn't come with a lot of specific instructions. But if you accept that children are rational as a first principle, as French society does, then many things begin to shift. If babies understand what you're saying to them, then you can teach them quite a lot, even while they're very young. That includes, for example, how to eat in a restaurant. The future Françoise Dolto was born, Françoise Marette, in 1908, into a large, well-off Catholic family in Paris. On the surface, she had a charmed life, violin lessons, a cook in the kitchen, and peacocks prancing around the backyard. She was groomed to marry well. But Françoise wasn't the discreet and obedient daughter that her parents expected. She wasn't sage comme une image. She was willful, outspoken, and passionately curious about the people around her. In her early letters, the young Dolto seems preternaturally aware of the troubling gap of understanding between herself and her parents. At age 8, she resolved to become a doctor of education, who intermediates between adults and children. It was a job that didn't yet exist, but that she later created. Having a profession was suddenly becoming possible for French women, like Simone de Beauvoir, who was also born in 1908. Françoise was part of the first generation of girls allowed to take the French baccalauréat, an exam at the end of high school that makes you eligible for university. After passing le bac, Dolto succumbed to her parents' pressure and settled for a nursing degree. It was only when her younger brother Philippe prepared to enter medical school that her parents allowed her to begin her medical studies too, chaperoned by him. She also entered psychoanalysis, which was then still quite unusual. Her family seemed to think this would purge Dolto of her unfeminine ambitions. In a letter to her written in 1934, Dolto's father said he hoped that psychoanalysis would help you to transform your nature, and that you will be, as you say, a real woman, which will add charm to your other qualities. But it was psychoanalysis under René Laforgue, who founded France's first psychoanalytic institute, that instead liberated Dolto to finally become a doctor of education. She studied both psychoanalysis and pediatrics, and trained in hospitals around France. Unusually for a parenting expert, Dolto was apparently an excellent parent to her own three children. Her daughter Catherine writes of her parents, "They never made us do our homework, for example. However, we did get bawled out, like everyone, when we had the bad grades. I got detention every Thursday for bad behavior. Mom said to me, 'It's too bad for you, it's you who has detention. When you get tired of it, you'll be able to hold your tongue.'" Dolto always maintained an unusually lucid memory of how she had seen the world as a child. She rejected the prevailing view that children should be treated as a collection of physical symptoms. At the time, bedwetters were still attached to pee-pee stops that released electric shocks. Instead, she spoke to children about their lives and assumed that many of their physical symptoms had psychological origins. "And you, what do you think?" she would ask her young patients. Dolto famously insisted that older children pay her at the end of each session with an object, like a stone, to emphasize their independence and accountability. This respect for children resonated strongly with Dolto's students. "She changed everything, and we the students wanted things to change," the psychoanalyst Myriam Seger recalls. Dolto's respect extended even to babies. A former student described her dealing with an upset infant who was several months old. "All of her senses on alert, totally receptive to the emotions that the baby aroused in her. It was not to console the baby, but to understand what the baby was telling her, or more precisely, what the baby saw." There are legendary stories about Dolto approaching previously inconsolable infants in the hospital and simply explaining to them why they were there and where their parents were. According to legend, the babies suddenly calmed down. This isn't American-style talking to babies, where you believe that babies recognize a mother's voice or are soothed by a calming sound. Nor is it a method to teach a child to speak or to prime him to become the next Jonathan Franzen. Rather, Dolto insisted that the content of what you say to a baby matters tremendously. She said it was crucial that parents tell their babies the truth in order to gently affirm what the babies already know. In fact, she thought that babies begin eavesdropping on adult conversations and intuiting the problems and conflicts swirling around them from the womb. She envisioned, in the pre-sonogram days, a conversation between a mother and her minutes-old baby going something like this. "You see, we were waiting for you. You're a little boy. Maybe you heard us saying that we wanted a little girl, but we're very happy that you're a little boy." Dolto wrote that a child should be included in conversations about his parents' divorce from the age of 6 months. When a grandparent dies, she said that even a young child should briefly attend the funeral. Someone in the family goes with him to say, "Voilà, it's the burial of your grandfather." It's something that happens in a society. For Dolto, the child's best interest is not always what will make him or her happy, but rational understanding, wrote MIT sociologist Sherry Turkle in an introduction to Dolto's When Parents Separate. Turkle writes that what a child most needs, according to Dolto, is a structured inner life able to support autonomy and further growth. Dolto was criticized by some foreign psychoanalysts for relying too much on her own intuition. But inside France, parents seemed to take both an intellectual and an aesthetic pleasure in her imaginative leaps. If Dolto's ideas ever reached English-speaking parents, they probably just sounded strange. American parents were under the sway of Dr. Spock, who was born 5 years before Dolto and also trained as a psychoanalyst. Spock wrote that a child can understand that he's about to have a baby brother or sister only from the age of about 18 months. His forte was listening carefully to parents, not to babies. Trust yourself. You know more than you think you do, is the famous opening salvo of his parenting guide, Baby and Child Care. For Dolto, it was children who knew more than anyone thought. Even into old age, when she was hooked to an oxygen tank, Dolto would get down on the floor with her young patients to see the world as they did. Her view from there was appealingly blunt.
If there's no jealousy when the baby comes, it's a very bad sign. The older child should show signs of jealousy, because for him, it is a problem. The first time that he sees everyone admiring someone younger than him, she said.
Dolto insisted that children have rational motives, even when they misbehave, and she said that it's the job of parents to listen and grasp these motives.
The child who has an unusual reaction always has a reason for having it. Our task is to understand what has happened, she says.
Dolto gives the example of a small child who suddenly refuses to continue walking down the street. To the parent, it just seems like sudden stubbornness, but to the child, there's a reason.
We should try to understand him and say, there's a reason. I don't understand, but let's think about it. Above all, don't suddenly make a drama out of it.
In one of the centennial tributes to Dolto, a French psychoanalyst summed up Dolto's teachings this way. Human beings speak to other human beings. Some of them are big, some of them are small, but they communicate.
Spock's giant tome, Baby and Child Care, seems like it's straining to contain every possible scenario involving children, from obstructed tear ducts to, in posthumous editions, gay parenting. But Dolto's books are pocket-sized. Instead of giving lots of specific instructions, she keeps returning to a few basic principles and seems to expect that parents will think things through on their own.
Dolto agreed to do the radio broadcasts on the condition that she could answer letters from parents rather than phone calls. She thought that parents would begin to see solutions simply by writing out their problems, Pradel, the radio host, remembers.
She told me, you'll see, one day, we'll get a letter from a person who's going to say to us, I'm sending you these pages, but I think I already understand. And we received one exactly like she predicted.
Like Spock in the United States, Dolto has been blamed in France for unleashing a wave of overly permissive parenting, especially in the 1970s and 80s. It's easy to see how her advice could be interpreted this way. Some parents surely thought that if they listened to what a child said, then they had to do what he said. This wasn't what Dolto advocated. She thought that parents should listen carefully to their kids and explain the world to them. But she thought that this world would of course include many limits, and that the child, being rational, could absorb and handle these limits. She didn't want to upend Rousseau's cadre model. She wanted to preserve it. She just added a huge measure of empathy and respect for the child, something that may have been lacking in France pre-1968. The parents I see in Paris today really do seem to have found a balance between listening to their kids and being clear that it's the parents who are in charge, even if they sometimes have to remind themselves of this. French parents listen to their kids all the time, but if little Agathe says she wants pain au chocolat for lunch, she isn't going to get it. French parents have made Dolto, standing on the shoulders of Rousseau, part of their parenting firmament. When a baby has a nightmare, you always reassure him by speaking to him, says Alexandra, who works in the Parisian daycare. I'm very much in favor of speech and language with children, even the smallest ones. They understand for me. They understand. The French magazine Parent says that if a baby is scared of strangers, his mother should warn him that a visitor will be coming over soon. Then, when the doorbell rings, tell him that the guest is here. Take a few seconds before opening the door. If he doesn't cry when he sees the stranger, don't forget to congratulate him. I hear of several cases where, upon bringing a baby home from the maternity hospital, French parents give the baby a tour of the house. French parents often just tell babies what they're doing to them. I'm picking you up. I'm changing your diaper. I'm getting ready to give you a bath. This isn't just to make soothing sounds. It's to convey information. And since the baby is a person, like any other, parents are often quite polite to him. Plus, it's apparently never too early to start instilling good manners. The practical implications of believing that a baby or toddler understands what you say and can act on it are considerable. It means you can teach him to sleep through the night early on, to not barge into your room every morning, to sit properly at the table, to eat only at mealtimes, and to not interrupt his parents. You can expect him to accommodate, at least a little bit, what his parents need, too. I get a strong taste of this when Bean is about 10 months old. She begins pulling herself up in front of a bookcase in our living room and pulling down all the books she can reach. This is irritating, of course, but I don't think I can stop her. Often I just pick up the books and put them back. But one morning, Simon's French friend, Lara, is visiting. When Lara sees Bean pulling the books down, she immediately kneels next to her and explains, patiently but firmly, "We don't do that." Then she shows Bean how to put the books back on the shelf and tells her to leave them there. Lara keeps using the French word, doucement, gently. After this, I start to notice that French parents say doucement all the time. I'm shocked when Bean listens to Lara and obeys. This incident revealed the enormous cultural gap between Lara and me as parents. I had assumed that Bean was a very cute, very wild creature with a lot of potential, but almost no self-control. If she occasionally behaved well, it was because of a kind of animalistic training, or just luck. After all, she couldn't talk, and didn't even have hair yet. But Lara, who at the time was childless, but now has two well-behaved daughters, assumed that, even at 10 months old, Bean could understand language and learn to control herself. She believed that Bean could do things doucement if she wanted to, and as a result, Bean did. Lotto died in 1988. Some of her intuitions about babies are now being confirmed by scientific experiments. Scientists have figured out that you can tell what babies know by measuring how long they look at one thing versus another. Like adults, babies look longer at things that surprise them. Beginning in the early 1990s, research using this method has shown that babies can do rudimentary math with objects, and that babies have an actual understanding of mental life. They have some grasp of how people think and why they act as they do, writes Yale psychologist Paul Bloom. A study at the University of British Columbia found that 8-month-olds understand probabilities. There's also evidence that babies have a moral sense. Bloom and other researchers showed 6- and 10-month-old babies a sort of puppet show in which a circle was trying to roll up a hill. A helper character helped the circle go up while a hinderer pushed it down. After the show, the babies were offered the helper and the hinderer on a tray. Almost all of them reached for the helper. Babies are drawn to the nice guy and repelled by the mean guy, Paul Bloom explains. Of course, these experiments don't prove that, as Dolto claims, babies understand speech, but they do seem to prove her point that, from a very young age, babies are rational. Their minds aren't a blooming, buzzing confusion. At the very least, we should watch what we say to them.